The Art of Leadership Network.
Welcome to the Smart Family Podcast, where we want to help you love being home. Here are your hosts, Dr. Rob Meter and Tony Newhoff.
Hi there, and welcome to the Smart Family Podcast. I'm Tony Newhoff, and I'm your host of today's program, and I am so very grateful that you've tuned in. Today's topic is brand new. We're talking about sensory processing disorder. I wonder if you've ever seen a child react and maybe even have a meltdown over walking into a bathroom in a public place, or being exposed to bright lights, or possibly fireworks, something that is a strong stimulus for one of their senses. Well, most children can handle it, and even though they might object to the strong lights or sounds or tastes, they'll go along with it. But in some cases, children have a stronger reaction. It's more like a meltdown, and parents can be left very confused about what's causing this, and is my child just being bad, or is there a discipline problem? Well, I think that's why it's so very important for us to talk about what a sensory processing disorder is. It's related to a difference in the brain, in the way the information's being perceived from these senses. And Rachel Harrington and Jessica Hill, our guests for today, are passionate certified occupational therapy assistants. They host a popular podcast. It's called All Things Sensory by Harkla. And it is hugely popular. They get over 60,000 downloads a month, and they talk all about sensory processing, special needs, parenting, and other topics related to child development. They have years of experience helping parents and educators and therapists to raise strong and confident children, no matter what their abilities are or their brain wiring or their reflexes. And so without any further ado, let's get into my conversation with Rachel Harrington and Jessica Hill.
I'm Rachel Harrington. I am a certified occupational therapy assistant with my autism certificate and now a certified primitive reflex clinical specialist, which is a mouthful. I am a mom of two littles. I have a three-year-old and a 15-month-old. And how did I get started in this area? I really didn't want to work with kids to begin with. And then I got a job at an outpatient pediatric clinic and ended up loving it. And then once I learned how impactful the sensory system can be on just everyday functioning, I just like dove into the topic and really haven't looked back since.
Thank you. And Jessica?
I'm Jessica Hill. I'm also a certified occupational therapy assistant, and I also am a certified primitive reflex clinical specialist as well. So Rachel and I actually went to school together for getting our OT degrees, and then we worked in a couple of outpatient clinics together. So that's how we know each other. And we've been doing business with each other ever since as well, and working together in a variety of different ventures. I'm also a mom to a 9-year-old. He just started fourth grade. Yeah, I love working with kids. Right now I'm working with kiddos in an outpatient pediatric OT clinic part-time, as well as working on all of the other things I do.
Mm-hmm. So yes, your skills are up to date as professionals, but also as moms. So let's just dive right in at a point where we can all start on the same page. So today's main topic is sensory processing disorders. Can you give me a layperson's definition for that?
So before I jump into really what sensory processing disorder is, I think it's important to note that it's not a recognized diagnosis yet in the DSM-5, which means that insurance isn't going to cover a therapist seeing a child for just sensory processing disorder. And so when I speak about sensory processing challenges, just know that they're all under that same umbrella and they're all kind of connected. And so really when we're thinking about sensory processing, we're thinking about your eight senses and how they are connecting with the environment and with your body. You think about sounds in your environment. Are they too loud? Are, you know, competing background noises, do they make you crazy and cringe and yell at your kids? Are you constantly craving movement? Are you getting motion sickness from riding in the car or sitting in the back seat? Those are all examples of sensory processing. Sensory processing challenges, really, because those signals are getting confused, or they're getting misfired, or they just don't, they're kind of like a traffic jam going from the body to the brain.
Okay. You mentioned that there are 8 senses, but I think most of us hear that there are 5. So can you explain that?
Yeah, the 5 main ones that we learn, but there's actually 3, we call them hidden senses, but they're so very important. The first one is vestibular, and this is our sense of movement and balance. We have receptors located in our inner ear, and anytime we have a head position change, so we turn and look, we go upside down, that vestibular system is activated to tell us where our body is and what we need to do. Another one is the proprioceptive system, and we have receptors in our muscles and our joints that tell us where our body is connected to the vestibular system, but also how our body is moving, where our arms and legs are in space, how much force to use with different activities like riding or throwing a ball. That's our proprioceptive sense. And then the last one is interoception, and that is all of the internal workings of your body. So understanding hunger and thirst cues, understanding when you need to use the bathroom, and then it also relates to emotional awareness as well.
Mm. I'm glad you raised emotional awareness, because it seems like this sensory processing could be very related, or at least manifest as being related to emotional sensitivity. And so can you maybe give me an example of a case where you might see emotional manifestations, but they're actually related to a sensory processing disorder? And how do you kind of tease that apart if there's an issue?
Yeah, oftentimes we'll see, and then the research clearly shows the connection between like a highly sensitive person or a highly sensitive child and sensory processing challenges, specifically over-responsivity, meaning that you're having an over-response or an overreaction to the specific sensory stimuli. And so an example would be a child maybe in a public bathroom and the dryers are going off, or they're having a meltdown because they don't want to go to the public bathroom because the toilet is too loud. So for someone who doesn't know that maybe that there's a connection to the sensory system there, they're thinking, wow, my child's being so naughty. They don't want to go to the bathroom. Why are they acting out? When we put on our sensory goggles and view it through that sensory lens, we can say, oh no, they're not being naughty. They're not struggling. They're not just, avoiding going to the bathroom just because they really are uncomfortable by the sounds in the bathroom, or maybe the smells, or maybe the lights, because, the lighting in bathrooms are, fluorescent and awkward and just uncomfortable. And so we see that connection between those highly sensitive kiddos, those highly sensitive adults, and that anxiety, those feelings of anxiousness, nerves in new environments. So really that's step one, is identifying that connection there.
Hmm. Wow. Well, I guess as the host of the show, I can ask you some questions. This is, at the risk of being maybe a little self-indulgent, I, for a long time have struggled with oversensitivity to sound. Like if I'm at a concert, I have to put earplugs in my ears before anyone else around me does, because the sound is just so loud. Oh, and as another example, when I put socks on, often they are just like itchy. The texture really bothers the skin around my ankles. I am so fussy about socks, but I don't know that I would actually have an SPD, or whether I am just sensitive in these ways. I mean, how would I know the difference?
Well, those are really good examples of what we call sensory quirks. And because we're all sensory beings, every single person on earth has a sensory system. We all have sensory quirks, and yours are that you don't like super loud noise and the tactile input from socks bothers you, but you have found ways to cope with it or manage it. You know, you use the earplugs or you are able to choose specific socks that don't bother you. So they're just more sensory quirks for you. If it was sensory processing disorder, you know, putting on socks every day would cause you to have a complete meltdown. You wouldn't be able to wear socks. Or if you tried to put socks on, you would be super in fight or flight. Mm-hmm. Or if you were to go to a concert that you of a band that you really loved, you wouldn't be able to tolerate being in the concert at all because your auditory system is, you know, so over responsive. So SPD is really when your sensory quirks and your sensory processing challenges are so impactful, they're negatively affecting your ability to get through your day.
For me personally, I am also sensitive to auditory input. And if I don't get enough movement during the day, or if I'm on the screens too much, I just feel like I'm quicker to flip my lid and I'm quicker to get more upset and bothered by those different sensory inputs, I guess.
Or like if you didn't get enough sleep the night before.
Exactly. You didn't eat right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you actually distinguish the sensory quirks from the actual diagnosis? I heard you say that it depends on, you know, whether you're maybe thrown into fight or flight or whether it's so extreme that it's having a negative impact on your life. Are there any other markers?
That's one of the biggest one that we see. And we initially, like if someone comes to us, they're like, hey, I'm struggling with this, this, and this, or my child is struggling with this, this, and this, this is what's happening. We always recommend getting an occupational therapy evaluation. We say when in doubt, rule it out. It's not going to hurt to have another opinion. But yeah, true sensory processing disorder would be quote unquote diagnosed by, would be diagnosed by an occupational therapist. We'd get referred to a therapist from the pediatrician. And from there, we would identify, okay, we'll complete our, you know, sensory profile, our sensory checklist, identify what, like how impactful these different sensory challenges are and where they're impacting the child the most.
Let's wind back a bit to the theory of how these develop. Like, what are the theories on how a sensory processing disorder, and can I call that SPD? Is that okay? Okay.
Yep.
Of how an SPD develops in a child, and why does it develop in some babies, some infants and children, and not in others?
Well, one thing that we've seen from the research is that it is highly genetic. So if the parents are struggling with sensory processing, then the child is more likely to also struggle. Mm-hmm.
And from there, we'll also see environmental toxins play a part. You think about our environments nowadays, highly toxic. You know, think about what you put in, on, and around your body. Also, I think screens and just our lifestyle, kind of that nature versus nurture, but our lifestyle is not the way that it used to be. Kids aren't outside climbing trees and running and riding bikes like they used to be. And when kids aren't getting that natural sensory input, they are going to be either craving it more or more sensitive to it when they do get it. So I think there's not a one size fits all, but it's definitely related to environment, genetics. Trauma is another big factor. I always say, you know, after pregnancy, I noticed a huge shift in my sensory processing abilities. And that's something that I've heard a lot of other moms go through as well. So really just impact to our nervous system.
And then, you know, we did talk briefly about primitive reflexes already, but we have seen a connection between retained primitive reflexes that are stuck in a child's body and their ability to process sensory input. There's definitely a connection there as well.
So do you find that SPDs normally manifest along with a diagnosis, like such as perhaps being on the autism spectrum, or maybe you can give me other examples, or does it also just happen in some individuals?
In my experience, it's a combination. You know, I've worked with kids who came in with just that standalone SPD diagnosis, even though it's not an official diagnosis, but they were referred for sensory processing challenges. And then I've also worked with a lot of kids who were autistic or ADHD or, you know, developmental delays who also struggled to process sensory input.
Mm-hmm. And does this typically continue throughout the child's lifetime? Or is there, you know, with some conditions such as asthma, for example, you may grow out of it? I'm putting that in air quotes.
Yes, that's a great question. So for someone who is diagnosed with like true sensory processing disorder, we don't see them growing out of it. We like to explain it as they learn to grow into it because it is a neurological condition. It's not something that you can grow out of. But for someone who has sensory quirks, that often changes as the child grows, as they hit puberty, as, you know, traumatic experiences happen, just as their life unfolds, we do notice those changes in their sensory system.
Let's shift and talk about what are the top three sensory processing disorders that you tend to see? And let's talk about some solutions as well.
The first one that comes to mind is a child who's a vestibular sensory seeker, who is always on the go. They're constantly moving. They really struggle to sit still. And oftentimes we'll see this diagnosed as ADHD, when in reality, it's actually a sensory processing disorder. And what's happening is that the child is not getting their sensory needs met by their daily activities. Their body needs more sensory input. So they're seeking it out in different ways. And most of the time, these kids aren't able to verbalize, hey, I need to get up and move so I can feel regulated. Instead, oftentimes it comes out as like a negative behavior, the child's being naughty, right? When in reality, they're just trying to feel regulated.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And the other one is, so that's like a sensory seeking child, the child who's seeking vestibular input, but we also have kind of the subtype of under responsive. And so for a child who's maybe under responsive to vestibular input, they are in need of more movement, but they aren't necessarily seeking it. They don't know how to go out and get it. So these are the kids who are generally considered like bumps on a log. They're a little bit chunkier. They're a little bit more low tone. They prefer video games, and they're getting that dopamine rush through something like a video game or a yummy chocolate snack. And so they're getting that input in a different way. They aren't actively and like, I quote unquote, obnoxiously seeking it, even though they need it. Whereas like a vestibular sensory seeker who's going to be, you know, running and jumping and bouncing off the walls, they're trying to get that input, but it's hard to meet that need.
And then the third one would be a child who's over responsive, which we talked about that a little bit with like your auditory system, you're over responsive. But if we're looking at a child who's over responsive to vestibular input, they're going to avoid movement activities. They're going to avoid swings on the playground and slides, and they might get motion sickness very easily. They're not going to like any activity where their feet leave the ground. They might struggle with riding a bicycle because their body doesn't know how to process all of that input, so they avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And these three things that we described, the sensory seeking, the under responsive, and the over responsive, they can happen in any of the eight sensory systems.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
like, for like non-layman's terms, that's like sensory modulation disorder. It's like one of the subtypes of true sensory processing disorder, but it's kind of confusing. It's like a whole tree, but that's just the one that we often see most in our clients. And that's kind of the most obvious sensory challenge and sensory deficit that we see.
For each of these that you've just described, the oversensitivity, under-responsiveness, over-responsiveness, what kinds of practical solutions do you give the child and their parents?
So for a sensory seeker, so the child who is like seeking out more of that input, they want it all the time, they need more to feel regulated, we want to give them the input that their body needs. So we call it meeting the sensory threshold, and that includes helping them complete the activities that their body needs to get. And then we typically will follow it up with some sort of calming activity afterwards. So this will happen a couple of times throughout the day so that they can stay regulated throughout the day, ideally. But it might look like first thing in the morning before the child goes to school, they complete some jumping and crashing onto a pile of cushions. And they do that 5 times. And then maybe they do some medicine ball slams 5 times. So they're getting a lot of full body input because they're seeking that input.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so going along with our under responsive, our kind of like bumps on a log type kiddos, if we're talking about vestibular input, we're still going to give them that input. We're going to help them get up and move and spin. And we're going to give them less of it because they aren't going to need quite as much as a sensory seeker. So maybe we'll get up and just go for a walk, or we'll, you know, walk up and down the stairs, or do some jumping jacks or some yoga. So they don't need quite as much, but we'll still follow that input with that calming proprioceptive input, because our proprioceptive system is like generally all calming and grounding. We generally, when in doubt, prop it out is what we say. You always want to organize the nervous system with proprioceptive input. And then a child who is over responsive to all of that movement, so they're avoiding it, our goal isn't to force them into these activities. Our goal would be to teach them how to process those types of activities by providing them with opportunities to try it in a safe way. So maybe as the parent, I sit on the swing and my child sits on my lap and we swing really slowly for 20 or 30 seconds, and then they get down and can go walk around. Because normally they might avoid that swing completely because they don't feel safe and secure because they can't process that input. But as the parent, I'll help them do it in a safe, comfortable way so that their brain can start learning how to process that input.
I would imagine that there are times where kids are resistant to doing these things. I wonder if there are age ranges that are like more open or less open to these kinds of interventions, and you know what you, how you coach parents to encourage their kids to cooperate. I mean, am I just speculating that you would have kids who don't cooperate?
No, there for sure are kids who don't. I don't know if it's necessarily an age thing. I think, you know, teenagers are typically a little more difficult to engage, just because they want to do their own thing. But overall, I think it mostly depends on how you approach the child and how you interact with the child and how you bring up the activity, right? So for example, a sensory seeker, if you say, your body's out of control, you need to go do this so your body gets under control, a kid's not going to respond to that the way that we want to, because it's forceful, it's uninviting, you know? So it's really about our approach.
Yeah, we like using a tool called the zones of regulation. And it's a picture color system that we begin to educate the child about what zone they're in, how they're feeling. And then we connect those emotions to a sensory tool. So let's say if a child is in the yellow zone, so it's blue, green, yellow, red. Blue is, you know, tired and sleepy. Green is happy and calm. Yellow, anxious, silly, wiggly. Red, mad, angry. And we approach that as, you know, talking about it for ourselves first. You know, mom is, I'm so frustrated right now. I'm in the yellow zone. I'm going to go take a break. I'm going to go take a walk. I'll be back in 10 minutes. And so we start by coaching them through what that looks like for ourselves. And then we can teach the child, oh, wow, what zone do you feel like your body's in right now? Oh, you're in the red zone. Okay, well, let's work through it. And then when they're calm, you can start teaching them those strategies that they can use in those moments. So if they're frustrated or angry, they can practice taking deep breaths, or they can go jump on the trampoline or go for a walk. And so you can start to teach them those connections there to the emotional strategies. And so really, I think it comes down to teaching them and getting them on board to learn that their body, there's nothing wrong. They're not in trouble. Their body just needs this input in order to feel their best.
How does a child's diet and sleep and, you know, I think we've already heard how exercise factors into this, but what about diet and sleep as factors in, you know, whether a child seems to be doing well managing with their SPD or whether they're not dealing so well?
I mean, I think it's everything. You know, I always will, whenever I'm talking to parents about it, I just ask them how they feel after a poor night's sleep. You know, if you feel short-tempered after a poor night's sleep, just imagine how your child feels after a poor night of sleep or after multiple nights of poor sleep. And then the same goes with food. You know, if we aren't getting good, nutritious food into our body, oftentimes it's going to make us feel sluggish. Or, you know, we work with a lot of picky eaters who have very limited food rapport. So they're not eating very many foods and they're not eating very much of the food. Chances are their body is going to be dysregulated because it doesn't have enough fuel.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that. I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only mom who had very picky eaters. What kind of work do you do with children who have like very sensitive taste buds?
We always want to figure out why the child is a picky eater, because sometimes it can be related to oral motor issues or a structural issue, like they have a swallow deficit or they have low muscle tone in their tongue and their cheeks and their lips, which causes them to feel unsafe when they're eating. So it's going to cause them to not eat a variety of foods because internally they don't feel safe. And the first thing with that, we'll typically work with a trained feeding specialist who knows a lot about the oral structures and the swallowing to help train the body to be able to do it safely. But if it is more of a texture challenge, then we want to incorporate a lot of fun sensory activities with food and different tactile inputs. So, you know, we'll do, and talking as a therapist right now, you know, if I'm working with a child in the clinic and they have feeding challenges and it's related to texture and tactile input, we'll have the parents bring food in and we'll play with the food. We won't try to eat it. There's no pressure to eat it, but we'll play with it. We'll touch it. We'll squish it. We'll touch it to our face and we'll just turn it into a game, because if a child can tolerate touching the food, they're more likely to tolerate putting it in their mouth and eventually eating it. Mm. Wow. And it's not the perfect system, but yeah. You know, their kids gonna have good days and bad days, but that's kind of the approach.
Is that something you encourage parents to do at home with their kids as well?
Absolutely. Oh, yes.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. As part of the therapeutic approach, does it help to involve kids in the kitchen, like in the process of like cooking food or picking it, cleaning it?
Yes.
Is that part of it as well?
Yes. And we love recommending kids, even just from an early age, going to the grocery store, helping them pick out the food and then taking it home, washing it, cutting it, you know, mixing it. Anytime that they can interact with the food without that pressure to eat it, they're going to be more willing to maybe pop a grape in their mouth. If they're confused about grapes, they're not sure if they like grapes, they're much more willing to try it. Even just including dips, like a bunch of different dips for the child to dip their cucumber in or their chicken nuggets in. It's new, it's different, it's a different tactile experience. So really any way that we can encourage participation with food that doesn't require them to eat it is going to be beneficial. Whether your child has a diagnosis or not, I mean, I have two toddlers right now who I'm working through this with and navigating that picky eating phase. And sometimes we just play with our food and we don't even require them to eat it when they first try it. Yeah.
How do you find that these solutions for kids with SPD affect the other kids in the family who maybe don't have an SPD? Do you ever have parents talk to you about that struggle?
Yes. What I've found is that oftentimes all of the children have sensory processing difficulties. It just looks different. You know, one child's a sensory seeker while the sibling is a sensory avoider. The next sibling is under responsive. So in my experience, there's often multiple children with SPD or sensory processing challenges. And so then at that point, we're like, okay, well, let's help give you strategies for all of them.
And something that I've heard too is maybe a family has a child who is acting out and is maybe struggling to process sensory input, and the parent responds differently to them than another sibling who maybe doesn't have sensory challenges or the same sensory challenges. And that's been a common thing that we've heard too, is how do I tell one child it's okay to jump on the couch and to bounce off the walls when you need it, but another child, you know, well, you know what, it's not appropriate right now to jump off the walls and do this, but Johnny needs this, but you don't. And that is a really challenging thing to navigate. And we always recommend teaching your family, your children, about the sensory system, how it processes, how everyone's brains are unique. Some people need X, Y, and Z, while other people need, you know, A, B, and C. And teaching rather than telling them, you know, this is why and this is how. It's like, no, let's actually get into it and explain the underlying reason.
Do you have any particular resources you recommend for parents to do that teaching?
We have a couple of our favorite books that we can recommend. Some of our favorite books are The Out of Sync Child, The Out of Sync Child Has Fun, Raising a Sensory Smart Child. For adults who are interested, Too Loud, Too Bright, Too Fast, Too Tight is a really great one. Any others that you can think of?
Those are my favorite.
Those are always our go-to. They do a great job of teaching like sensory challenges and those underlying reasons. And then the Zones of Regulation, like I mentioned earlier, is another program to really teach those underlying emotional skills.
Right. And the authors of those resources.
Oh, goodness.
I think we'll definitely put them in the episode notes.
If you search for them, they'll come up.
Yeah,
I know
they'll pop right up.
The Out of Sync Child is by Carol Kranowitz. Too Loud, Too Smart, Too Bright, Too Tight. I think that's by Sharon Heller, maybe? Sharon Heller. She's a PhD. And then
the Zones of Regulation, their website will come out. And that is an entire like curriculum or program.
Okay.
You don't have to purchase it to learn about it, but it is like an entire program.
I would bet, and I think you've alluded to this earlier, that you sometimes have a child who's the client, but also you would notice SPD traits in their parent, or maybe have an overstimulated parent. How do you manage that in the therapeutic setting? Like, what's your approach?
That's a great question. Generally, once the child comes to us and they're receiving occupational therapy services, we kind of open a can of worms, and the parent will start to have conversations with us like, oh yeah, I did that as a kid, or oh, I think I have some sensory things going on as well. And they'll start to have those aha moments. But really managing it in a therapy setting, it comes down to teaching and helping these parents learn strategies to regulate their own bodies. And so you think about the oxygen mask, you know, the oxygen mask, what's the word?
On the airplane.
On the airplane.
On a flight. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you have to be able to put your oxygen mask on first before you can help your child. And the same thing goes with the sensory system. If you are anxious and overwhelmed and overstimulated, there's no way that you are going to be able to help your child. Your child is just going to feed off of that, and they're going to be more anxious and uncomfortable because that's how mom or dad is feeling, you know? So we need to make sure that we are modeling regulation strategies. We're taking care of our own, you know, biological needs before we're then helping our child.
Mm-hmm. Are most parents open to that? You say that they typically raise it in conversation. What if they don't raise it?
Sometimes we'll ask questions. You know, oftentimes if a parent is not providing lots of information to us, we have to ask more questions mm-hmm. so that we can get that information from them.
Yeah. And just like we mentioned, you have to build rapport with the clients. You really have to build that rapport and trust with their parents and with their caregivers as well. And so if they're not feeling that comfort in the ability to confide in you and to have those open and honest conversations, like, you know what, this week was really tough. I yelled at my child when he was, you know, plugging his ears when he had to go to the bathroom because and you know, it was hard, and you have to be able to have those honest conversations. So building that rapport and connection is so important from a therapeutic use of self standpoint.
Well, this has been such an enlightening conversation, Rachel and Jessica. How can people connect with you and find your resources?
You can go to our website. It's harkla.co, harkla.co. And we have a lot of free information on our website. We have a podcast, we have YouTube, we have blog posts, we have free webinars, along with like our paid products as well.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Well, I hope you found that conversation as enlightening as I did. I certainly had takeaways from what Rachel and Jessica had to say. It was interesting to learn that there is a difference between having a sensory quirk, you know, such as my sensitivity to socks, and an actual sensory processing disorder, where a child may be so overwhelmed that it causes them to have a meltdown. And if your child has experienced any symptoms like that, it's worthwhile to have the occupational therapy assessment just to see whether there's something going on with their sensory processing. Secondly, I was so thrilled to hear Rachel and Jessica talk about the zones of regulation and how important it is for parents to talk about this issue with their kids, to delve into some family education about these differences and bring your family to a higher level of understanding. And if you'd like a link to that website that they mentioned on the zones of regulation, just see our episode notes on our website. And it's so worth it to have an occupational therapy assessment, because it's not the kind of situation where a child is going to grow out of this sensory inclination, the ways that they perceive these inputs. It's more a case where they need to grow into it. They need to grow into integration strategies. And there are practical solutions that will help your child adapt to the way their brain perceives these sensory inputs. So thank you so much again for joining me today for this podcast. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share it with a friend, with somebody who also may find it helpful. And we would be so grateful if you would hop onto Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We always love to hear suggestions for experts or topics. If there's anything you're struggling with at home, please do drop us a note either through our website or through Instagram, just Smart Family Podcast. Drop us a line, tell us what you're worried about or what has been keeping you up at night, and we'll do our best to respond and bring you an expert in that area, because it is truly our heartbeat to help you love being home.